accession number 21018, Rule 1.
Dr. Schwartz, Rule 1, where were you born, please?
Glasgow.
Which year was this?
In 1923.
Did both your parents come from Glasgow?
Yes, from Glasgow. Well, no, yes, from Glasgow. My mother was born in Philadelphia. Well, Glasgow Irish family. My father was born in Glasgow of a German family from the Schwarzwald. And they came to... I'm still trying to find out exactly when they came to Glasgow. I've been finding out some interesting things about them, that my grandfather had come to Wales and had joined the 2nd Battalion Volunteers of the French Rifles and had won the Marksmanship Cup for the regiment. And that must have been about 1876 or so, before they came to Glasgow. However, that's the whole story, you know.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was an optician. My grandfather was a watchmaker. The three brothers had come from the Black Forest about this, between 1864 and 76, you know.
Did you go to school in Glasgow?
Yes, yes, I did. I went to school in Glasgow. That's St. Aloysius College, first of all, and then Holyrood Secondary. Holyrood School, it's called now. And then I joined up when I was 18, when I was still in at school. I joined the RAF. I was a wireless operated air gunner.
Had you heard Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I had, yes. I was only 16 at the time, and to us it was a great big thrill, rather than, you know, we couldn't see the significance of it, you know.
Why did you decide to go in for the RAF?
Well, I wanted to be a wireless operated air gunner. That was my idea, yeah.
Had you been in any bombing of Glasgow before
that? Yes, yes. But it wasn't very much, you know. Glasgow was, again, to us it was exciting, rather than, we were far enough away from Clydebank not to get the worst of it.
What was your address in Glasgow at the time?
17 Myrtle Park. 17 Myrtle Park. That's Cross Hill, Glasgow.
Did any bombs fall near your house?
One fell about 200 yards away.
Did people use shelters?
In our area, we didn't have to. Everyone tried to stay indoors, but all the young ones went outside to see what was happening. But as I see, we were quite a couple of miles from Clydebank as the crow flies, so they were getting the worst of it, you know.
And once you joined the RAF, what was the procedure for joining up?
Well, I just joined. I joined when I was 18, very much against my parents' wishes. I joined then. That was in January 41. And then I got my call-up papers about June, late June. And into the RAF on the 22nd of July 41.
Why were your parents so opposed to it?
Well, because I had a potential career at school and university. You know, 18, I should have gone on for university.
Where did you do the training, first of all?
Well, Blackpool, first of all, we started the wireless operator course, and then Compton Bassett, which is number two, I think, or number three wireless school. And from then, I was posted to gunnery school. That was number 10. Air Gunnery School in Barrow-in-Furness, Walney Island. And there we had to wait in a queue, the wireless operators. But every 3 weeks, two more went on to the course. So while I was waiting, then a call came around about late November for volunteers for special service. So I went for that. I got paid up waiting for the other. And it turned out it was RAF. At that time, they were... They were combined operations, that's all we knew, but they hadn't formed the beach squadrons then. So from then on, from December 41, 42 rather, we were assembled and we got into groups and we started doing exercises all over the country, up and down the country for the next 18 months or so. After about...
What did the exercises consist of?
Well, we formed these mobile units. We would go out and exercise for sometimes 3 days, set up signals and contact other groups, other units, and back again. Sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks. And we started the big amphibious exercise. The very first that I went on was pirate excise pirate, where he sailed from Southampton in huge convoys, and we landed in Dorset, I think it's Swanage, attacked from there and moved into, advanced into New Forest, and we landed at a place called Stony Cross, where there was a satellite airfield there, which we captured and set up our stations there. But that particular exercise, but after two days, an umpire came along and put a great cross on all our tents and said, "You've been bombed, and you're no longer in it." So we just sat there and starved for 2 weeks until something finished. From then on, we did odd things like that. We'd go back, every time we finished the next exercise, we'd go back to Chigwell, RAF Chigwell, where they were forming all the RAF mobile units, all these fancy ones going to the desert and this and that and the next thing. And then the next thing, they sent us up to HMS Dundonald, which is a commando school for the RAN commanders and their RAF commanders. And also, number 4 commander came in and did a few exercises there too, Lord Lovett's at that time. He later became brigadier, of course. So that's what we did for the next, from about December 42 till, till end of April 44.
So these special units you were in, what was their official title?
Well, first of all, we were called number 8 FFHQ, which is number 8 Field Force Headquarters. And we had 3 advanced landing grounds, ALGs. I think it was number 8, number 9, and I think number 11. And that didn't last very long because they obviously changed the structure. But another day, we started going to Dundonald for these courses. We did a course in April 42, it must have been. Oh, 43, that would be, April 43. A couple more exercises, then back to Chigwell, who sent us back to Dundonald again. And from Dundonald, after that, we came back from Dundonald about the end of June, and they took some of our group off and sent them to Sicily, on the Sicily landings. And the reformed us from then on was to what was called number 1 RAF Beach Squadron. The Beach Squadron from there, and 1, 2, and 4, 3, as I say, came later.
And what was the function of these beach squadrons?
Well, the beach squadrons were really part of the beach groups, the beach block, to look after RAF supplies and to return pilots who'd been shot down, this sort of thing, and to send people out to the various aircraft which were been shot down, all this, the recovery of aircraft, all sorts of things like that. That was the idea of the whole squadron. We had signals, never quite knew what we were supposed to do except take signals, that was it. So, I mean, and everything was in codes, so we knew what we were doing that way. So, when it came to the briefing exercise, as I say, we went to, when we came to the beach squadron, and again we started doing more exercises, and by this time they'd formed the other beach squadrons. We kept going out and exercised, back again, out and back again, so on. And back to Dundonald a couple of times after that too, just to fill in time. I think we had nothing else for us to do. So there you are.
What kind of equipment were you using as a signaller?
Well, first of all, using RAF aircraft equipment. I think it was called a TR-53 and 54, the big set which was used in aircraft. We had our tents. We carried, we had 3 lorries and a small, forget the name of the exit, a small truck in front, and we had 2 dispatch riders. We all had to do different courses. We were all supposed to do everything, but the 2 of them did dispatch riding, and they became motorcycles entirely. Another about 6 altogether did lorry driving, and they took it in turns. Some of us did cookery. We were all supposed to do cooking, and I did mine, you know, mine lifting, mine detecting, that sort of thing, which I know nothing about yet. But we all did some of that, you see, so you're supposed to interchange. So all had different responsibilities, in, if necessary, you know.
And what do you remember about the personnel in your unit? Do you remember any of their names? And their
yes, I remember, yes. The signal section was very small, and we assumed we were the entire beat squadron, of course, we weren't, of course. We were able to work a 4 watch system, 2 men per watch. The 4 watch system is a very nice way of doing your signals, because you get you start your watch system, say midnight to 8, what the first watch. You can go to sleep from 8 to 4 potentially. in 4 to midnight, so that's one day you've lost completely. But the next day you're on from 12 to 4, the afternoon only, short lift, short watch. And then the next day you go on at 8 to 12, and you're off for 36 hours. So that's a lovely way of doing it. You know, the Navy, I think, did a 3-watch system, which is much more difficult and harder than everybody else. So we had enough personnel to do that. So, as I say, we had the wireless operator, and we'd also about 3 or 4 wireless mechanics, and a couple of electricians, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's all. But we were entirely signals.
Do the names of any of your particular friends and comrades stick in your mind?
Oh, yes. Savage, Dunnocky. Dunnocky and I, great. You worked in pairs, Jimmy, on your commander course in this. So, and Dunnocky and I, he was a great big, tall Scotsman. He and I were together for so many years after that evening. Lowndes, McIntosh, yes, he was one of our only casualties. We only had 2 casualties, actually. McIntosh, I can remember most of them when I think of it, you know.
Were there any particular problems that you had in functioning as a unit?
In what way?
Anything at all?
No, not really. We ran up and down the country. We enjoyed it generally, but it became a bind at times, you know. But we enjoyed it generally. When we were down south, like the Scots boys, we got no leave at all when we were down south, because if we need enough London, all the London boys, if we had a weekend free, they got all the passes, you know. Every so often we got into Chiggles, where we were quite near London anyway, so we saw a little bit of London there, and used to get down to Tottenham Hotspur a lot, and actually there were 4 teams using the White Hart Lane at that time, so that's about as much as we saw. Saw a few of the London raids and the mini blitz of 44, early 44.
What did you see of that?
Well, it was only 2 or 3 raids through the January, and we happened to be in Tiggle for most of them. There wasn't anything very terrible happening near us at all, but when you're down in London, the sirens went and you scattered, everybody scattered, one way or another. I always hated being out, being indoors in a raid. I preferred to be out in the street. I had a horror of being buried alive, so I'd rather dodge it in the street. But I was never near anything very dangerous when it comes to, you know.
And in your job, were you both transmitting and receiving?
Yeah. When you're on watch, yes, you're on, usually 2 of you on watch, but of course in the beat squadrons that are being trained for the more or less the army side, 2 tend to be 1 being on guard or on patrol and that other on watch, and then you kept turning over, but you stayed together, the 2, you know, throughout the whole thing.
And who was in overall charge of the beat squadron?
Well, the beat squadron was the wing commander, wing commander Fulton. We never met him until about May 44. Our own CO for the signals flight was a flight lieutenant Tebe. And he was with us throughout that time. He was flying officer to begin with, but he was up to flight lieutenant, suppose, and he was our signals officer. And we had a 1 signals warrant officer, and then a flight sergeant signals. A couple of sergeants signals, yes, but 2 corporals. The rest of us were all just ERCs. I was LAC.
What happened next in the sequence of events as far as you were concerned?
Well, one of the interesting things was that I was going and doing these exercises all over the place. And in April, beginning of April 44, we were on an exercise down to Kent. Now, it's around, somewhere around West Marling, a little ditch we were living in. I had to put up a tent in that. And they were only there about 2 days when dispatch radio came. Most of our stuff came by dispatch radio. This was all part of the training, I suppose. Most of the signals, so, you know, we were doing sort of, I suppose, imitation signal or just procedure in that signal on our general work. As we're in code, we couldn't tell anyways, but we got this signal to pack up and start off again. Again, the interesting thing about it was that we didn't, even our CO didn't know where we were going eventually, because halfway up we got up in our own convoy of 3 or 4, our own little three lorries and the other things. But you maybe join up with an army convoy on the way. At some point, another dispatch rider would come with another message and you would change course. You see, the CO knew all this, and it came down to us a bit by bit. Oh, what's going on? So we assumed we were going back to Dundonald for another course, which they shoved us on every so often when there was obviously nothing else for us to do. But we went up to north and didn't go to didn't turn west at the border, we went straight on up to Stirling. And we stopped overnight at Stirling. When you stayed overnight in these things, you either slept in the lorry or underneath it or just wandered around through the night, you know. The next day they went up to Perth, which wasn't a very long haul. We stayed at the barracks in Perth, Black Watch Barracks. And the next night we went up to Inverness, stayed in the Cameron Barracks. And the next night we went up to towards Dingwall, and we landed in a place called Bran Castle, which turned out to be the home of the Mackenzie of Seaforth. And we stayed there for about 2 or 3 weeks. We knew there was a big exercise going on. And then we came all the way back down again, and so we went into concentration camps and the assembly camps then. Now it transpired, I've since found out just why it was. It was one of the last exercises, and they didn't use us on it because we had done something similar before, but the exercise took off from about 92 miles north, and they landed at a beach which was the replica of the beach we were landing on. I can actually show you this.
No, because you've got the mic on.
Oh, yeah. But... there's a little beach from Burghead to, I can't remember the name of the place on the western side, but it's about the same size as the beach at Wistron. I mean, you see it in that, you can see just how close it was to it, you know. However, as I say, we didn't go on the actual landing itself because apparently we'd done this, something very similar before. All the way back down into the assembly camps, and from then on we just moved from one camp to the other when the time came. We were briefed. But the 23rd of May, we got our big briefing. And towards the end of May, we started moving up stage by stage till we got to Gosport. We went aboard on an LST on 3rd of June, midnight on the 3rd of June it was. And yes, we're almost dead on midnight when we went aboard. And that was that. So we stopped there for the Sunday and the Monday and off, and sometime through the Monday night, but I was sleeping, so I didn't remember when it went off. And next thing, we were more than halfway across the channel.
What was your crossing like?
Very, very quiet. And when I eventually woke up, went outside, it was a broad daylight. It was quite nice. As we got nearer the beach, nearer Normandy, well, we didn't know quite how near we were. We saw the first hospital ship came back, and that sort of stunned us all a little bit. It's the white ship with the big red crosses, you know. I don't know just how far out we were then. So on we plodded then, and it got nearer and nearer, and then you could see the sound of the activity and hear the sound and see the flash and all that. And then as we were coming in, there was big congestion, all ships all over. We got closer and closer, and it got darker and darker. A lot of the dark was, of course, the smoke from the bombing and the shelling and everything else. At some time, well, I'm never really able to work out the exact time, there was a sudden sort of roar over us. I mean, there was no ACAC at that, so it may have been one of our own, but there was bombs that came down, three bombs, whoosh, 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 three fissiles. We went up in the air and down. It seemed like about 50 feet, I was near the stern of the ship, down with a big splash, and then there a torrent of water poured over us, and that was that. We saw three flashes. But there we were lying, apparently crippled. We moved on a little bit, and sure enough, whatever it was had damaged the LST, the stern, because when it came daylight, we could see the taffrail was out in the bend, and the taffrail with the bomb had hit and gone underneath. So whether it was one of our distancing bombs or whether it was the Jerry, I don't know at all yet. But so there we were lying, crippled. So as we got, that was us, and as we got nearer the... They limped on a little bit, but as daylight came, you could see we were very close to the beach, but we couldn't move any further, so we were just watching from then on. We'd seen, of course, the airborne and all that coming over about late in the evening, actually, before that thing happened to us. So, yeah, so we stuck there most of the day just looking, watching what was going on in the beach. And eventually they took us off by Rhino. Our LST couldn't go any further, so they took us off by Rhino. And we were very fortunate, really, because by the time we got ashore, it was almost 7 o'clock. This was on D plus one, actually. We'd been lying off the beach from D-Day itself.
How did you transfer from the LST to the Rhino?
Well, they just opened the gates and off we went. You know, opened the put the big doors there, and we went onto the Rhino. But the good thing for us was that the Rhino was straight up to the beach, and it was very high tide that night. About 7 o'clock, we just stepped from the Rhino onto the sand, didn't even get our feet wet.
Which beach was that?
This was Sword Beach, Queen Red of Sword Beach, right at La Breche.
Was there any fire going on when you landed?
No, everything was very, very quiet. There had been some beforehand, they came around the water and that. Yes, that was the beach we landed on, but this is a more or less a first. But walk past that hotel, which is also this, which I stay in every year now at the same hotel.
Hotel de la Breche,
yeah.
It's called.
No, it had been a German strong point. There were no glass in the windows of that. But fortunately, they didn't defend it. They left it fairly quickly. So that could have been very bad.
Were you able to unload all your stuff?
Well, we were very lucky again. Because of our stuff being wireless equipment, they had decided we couldn't do wet landings on it. They were taken aboard on jeeps and trucks. So in our case, we just went ashore with our Sten guns and magazines, with three magazines in each pouch. And went up that road towards Ermenville. Just the usual battle order, supposed to be 10 paces between each, wasn't quite as much as that. So four on one side and three on another. We had been split up into different sections, I mean, you know, to avoid everybody being lost. There was another batch went ashore on another LST, but another LST, there were three. I think three, only seven of us in that. We weren't all wild at all, but that's the way we went up the road. And we stopped, our first stop was this farm, like an area, a farm, the very first farm on the left going up into Ermenville. And we dug in there for the night. We started setting up our radio equipment then. It should have been up the night before. We had been briefed to set up at 7 o'clock on the 6th of June, but this would be now the 7th of June. And also, we had also been briefed, whereas the other two beach squadrons had to stay in their areas, we had been briefed to set up a station in the docks at Kong, in a particular warehouse. But they also said, well, there were over 17 or 18 other plans, so don't worry too much about that. But that had been our briefing for D-Day. We should have been set up our station in Kong itself, which they had presumed to be taken then, yeah. So we dug in there, and we got stuck in there, and that was us. We never got near Kong after that. We were near enough to see, very, very near, actually, because we got a very front seat of the bombing of Kong and everything else, you know, and also the Operation Goodwood and all that. But so that was it. We stuck there until the end of August.
How did the work go?
Oh, we were working all the time. We were on signal duty all the time. And for the first week or so, apart from being on watch, as soon as you came off watch, you were either on guard or on patrol or doing something around the place, you know, maintenance, this sort of thing. But by about the second or third week, we were reasonably comfortable. And also, by that time, we got our dugouts fairly comfortable too. You know, we expanded them. The first three or four nights, we were in a little slit trench, a two-tier slit trench, and it was very, very tight and very nasty, very unpleasant. And of course, although there wasn't any German air activity through the day, every night they came over, and obviously with Sword being right at the extreme left flank, if they threw something down, the bomb, something, it should have hit somebody, so you got it every night, you know. So that was a bane. But at first, I must say that there's elation over the first few days. But by about the middle of the second week, you began to get worried. And then from then on, it just got worse and worse. So you got to the stage where you really were bomb happy, and if somebody dropped a spoon on our mess and that, you jumped, their guts fell and all this sort of thing, you know. Because another thing I had to contend with is the Navy bombarding. And when they went off and the big ships let fly through the night or through the day, and if you're trying to sleep, you're heaved off the ground, you felt you're lifted up at 4 feet and down again, you know. So by the time you came out, we were all a bit shaky, and that's it.
Had you expected the breakout to come sooner than it did?
Oh, yes. Yeah, originally we did. Then once we were there, we realised it wasn't going to happen, you know. As I say, I mean, we had thought that going into this, that if things had transpired, we'd gone to Kong, that was fine. And I must say, once when the airborne reinforcement came over around D-Day night itself, most of us thought, oh, this is fine, it's all over now, we've won.
Any contact with local civilians?
Not an awful lot then. It's, they were all very friendly in that, but since then I've met it quite a lot. When I go each year, I met people who were 12 and 13 at that time. I got to know them quite well, you know. I often feel there should be a branch of Normandy veterans for the people who are there, because they are veterans too, and most of them suffered a lot more than we did.
Any incidents that happened to you in Normandy?
Nothing particularly. It's one very interesting one with myself. And one day there was an artillery stonk or mortar or that, and I dived into a ditch. And a while later, somebody else joined me, it's a great big thump, and this bloke came down, and he was a Scotsman. And he was in the Black Watch, the 51st, which are about half a mile away from us, actually. And he was very gruff, and not a very, very happy character at all. But I started chatting with a Scotsman, and he had been in the Argyles at St. Valerie. Now, a friend of mine at school, one of my friends at school, his brother had been in the first group of militia, the first call-up, you know, to the Argyll and Sutherland. And he was missing at St. Valerie. And of course, her mother always thought he would turn up again. You know, I used to find this, the family, where the father was, he'd been in the First War, he wasn't too happy about it. However, this bloke, I said, he'd been with him at St. Valerie. I said, did you know Corporal McVeigh at all? He said, ah, yeah. I said, he's supposed to be missing. He said, he's not missing. If I was with him, he's dead. He said, he kicked open a door and it was a booby trap. So that was the first thing, you know, I knew definitely about that, Lenny McVeigh. I never got into telling him family. I just couldn't tell him family, you know. Come and leave after that. Again, people talked about him and that, and I just couldn't tell that family at all.
And did your equipment work all right?
Oh, yes, that was fine, yeah. Yes, we just carried ordinary routine watches. We just kept the heads down at night, that's about it.
What happened to you when the breakout came?
Well, that was okay, pleasant surprise. First of all, Paris, the first thing, well, the big excitement, I suppose, was Paris. We knew about the breakout a bit before that. We kept getting stories about what it was like up in the Falaise Gap. And also Alan Melville told us how nasty it was. I've got a recording of him flying over the gap itself. So that was that. By that time, we weren't doing very much. We were still doing signals and all that, but not much work at all, not much traffic. And then on the day we came out, they drove us through Kong to see what we should have seen. And it was all massive rubble, mountains of rubble here and there. And then just went on up to Aramongs and came back on an LSI. It was the LCI, one of the landing craft infantry, one of the unpleasant ones with the ramps down the side, you know, because that was a very rough crossing. And that was that. We came back to England, went and leave. Then we came back to Chigal to be reformed into other units. And we were reformed into one called 105 SP, 105 Staging Post. Again, we were going out on under canvas tents and all this. We were out to a place called, I think it was called Cricklade Farm, near the source of the Thames. But while we were there, a CEO came up to us and said, he called three of us together. It was Dunnocky, myself, and this bloke, Savage. He said, you know, you're the only unmarried ones left, and I've got to get three volunteers. He said, would you mind going to Paris? That was fine. However, so we had more or less had to volunteer. But actually, what we're volunteering for was, he wanted, this is an ATSU, Air Transportable Signals Unit, which was the RAF equivalent of airborne, and these were new units. The idea was that they would go with all their equipment all set up so people to start right away, either on an airfield or wherever it was. So three of us went out to Paris to number 5 ATSU.
5?
ATSU, ATSU, Air Transportable Signals Unit. They were very in their infancy then. There were only very few of them altogether. However, when we got there, the CEO very quickly pointed out, they said, you're only attached to us, you know, you're not posted. And they were quite a bit resentful about us too. And that was because we were wearing the combined ops badges, which we were entitled to wear and had to wear, actually. And about 3 or 4 days after we were there, they were posted, and they went off and left. They said, oh, you're, and they detached us. And another unit came along, and they were there about 6 or 7 months, and they detached us again. So we stayed there. Sabi's Dunaki and I stayed there until, well, I was